January 27th, 2013. Bradenton, Florida. After taking his boat out onto the Braden River, 52-year-old Patrick Mullins fails to return home, and the abandoned boat is discovered several miles away at Egmont Channel the following day. 9 days after he went missing, Pat is found floating in Tampa Bay, and it turns out he was fatally shot through the head and was weighed down with an anchor tied to a rope wrapped around his body. His official cause of death is listed as undetermined, but while law enforcement leans towards suicide, Pat's loved ones notice some odd discrepancies to make them believe he was murdered. A family friend displays suspicious behavior to suggest he might have knowledge of what happened, but there is no evidence to implicate him, and no conclusive answers about Pat's death. After that, the trail went cold. Happy New Year, everyone, and welcome to 2024's first episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and to start the year off, we're going to be exploring a controversial case in which there's been debate about whether a homicide or suicide took place. The unexplained 2013 death of Patrick Mullins. As you probably know, the case was featured on an episode of the Unsolved Mysteries reboot on Netflix titled Body in the Bay, and this marks the first time we've covered a mystery from the series' third season, which dropped during the fall of 2022. I've talked about this on previous episodes, but one piece of criticism which has been directed at the Unsolved Mysteries reboot is that they have profiled a number of suspicious deaths which were ruled to be suicide or accidental, but even though the victims' loved ones were certain that foul play had taken place, the series would sometimes leave out key pieces of information to fit their narrative and make the story seem more mysterious than it really was. In some of these cases, it seemed like suicide or accidental death was the correct ruling all along, but there's a lot more ambiguity in the case of Patrick Mullins, because the medical examiner officially ruled his death to be undetermined. Of course, law enforcement leaned towards Pat's death being a suicide, even though by all accounts, he was a loving husband and father who had a lot of good things going on in his life, and gave off no warning signs that he was suicidal. Investigators believe that when Pat went out on his boat, he made a calculated decision to tie an anchor to his body before shooting himself in the head with a shotgun in hopes that he would fall overboard and the anchor would weigh him down in the water. But the biggest problem with that theory is that no shotgun was ever found, Pat never owned a shotgun, and there's no record of him ever obtaining one. This is why Pat's family theorized that while he was out on the water, he may have stumbled across something he shouldn't have seen, such as a drug deal, and this ultimately cost him his life. These rumors would grow when a friend of the Mullins family with known addiction issues started displaying paranoid and erratic behavior following Pat's death, which seemed to suggest that he might have had some inside knowledge about what happened. This is definitely a very odd case with no concrete evidence pointing towards homicide or suicide, so we're going to try and figure out what happened on this episode. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, including stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content, as our Patreon page currently has over 60 exclusive bonus episodes in our archives, which are not available on a regular feed. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the death of Patrick Mullins. Thank you. Our story begins in 2013 in Bradenton, Florida, which is located along the Gulf Coast in Manatee County, just south of Tampa, and had a population of around 50,000 at that time. Our central figure is 52-year-old Patrick Lee Mullins, who goes by the name Pat. Pat lives with his wife Jill Mullins at a house in the Lychee Acres neighborhood, and at this particular point, they are only 5 months shy of their 30th wedding anniversary. The couple also have two grown sons, 26-year-old Mason, who is serving with the U.S. Army on a tour of Afghanistan, and 24-year-old Miles, who is attending the University of South Florida in Tampa in order to major in civil engineering. Pat spent 2 decades working as a 4th grade teacher and also served 6 years as a sergeant in the National Guard, where his duties included helping survivors of Hurricane Andrew in 1992. Jill had also been a teacher, but she and Pat both decided to get their master's degrees at the University of South Florida and become librarians and media specialists at separate schools. Pat has spent the past 9 years working this job at Palmetto High School in the nearby town of Palmetto, and by all accounts, he is very well liked by the faculty and students there, as he always goes out of his way to help his students and function as a father figure for them if needed. However, Pat is now 1 year away from retiring from this job, and since he is a member of the Deferred Retirement Option Program, he would stand to collect over $150,000. Since Pat is passionate about collecting and restoring old motors and boats, he is hoping to use that money to start a new business for this with his brother Bert. Indeed, the backyard of the Mullins residence is located near a canal which leads into the Braden River, and Pat has a work shed next to his dock containing half a dozen old boat motors he is working on. The Mullins family has always spent a lot of time on the water swimming, boating, and fishing, and Pat owns a 14-foot, flat-bottom, Stumpknocker brand riverboat, which he brings out into the water at any opportunity. On Sunday, January the 27th, Jill traveled to a relative's residence in Sarasota while Pat remained at home, but when she returned between 6:30 and 7 p.m. that evening, she was surprised to discover that Pat was not there, even though his puck was still parked in the driveway. She tried calling Pat's cell phone a few times and got no answer, but the phone turned out to be inside his truck, since he did not often carry it with him. Jill soon noticed that Pat's boat was missing from the dock and figured he had gone out on the water. But when it got dark and Pat failed to return, Jill grew concerned, as he did not often use the boat at night since his navigation lights were inoperative. When Pat failed to resurface, Jill decided to call their son Miles at the University of South Florida, and he agreed to travel to Bradenton. Miles was also joined by one of Pat's brothers, Bert Mullins, as they both took a boat out onto the Braden River to search for Pat. When they had no luck finding him, Jill called the Manatee County Sheriff's Office at around 11 p.m. in order to officially report Pat missing. The Mullins' neighbors would recall having seen Pat mowing his lawn during the afternoon, and one witness saw him take his boat out into the water sometime between 3:30 and 4 p.m. After checking a few local boat bars to confirm that Pat was not there, the sheriff's office launched a search operation which involved their marine unit, the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, aka the FWC, and the United States Coast Guard. Well, at around 11 a.m. on January the 28th, about 19 to 20 hours after Pat was last seen, his abandoned boat was discovered in Egmont Channel. It was drifting into the Gulf of Mexico between marker buoys 9 and 10 at a spot about 7 miles northwest of Egmont Key. Large container ships would often use Egmont Channel to deliver goods, and since it would have taken Pat between 2 to 3 hours to travel to the area from his residence, no one could figure out what his boat was doing there. A number of Pat's belongings, including a life vest, sunglasses, straw hat, and gas can, were still on board, but Pat himself was nowhere to be found, and the boat's anchor also happened to be missing. The boat was out of gas, but since the ignition was on and the engine was in neutral, it may have run out of fuel while remaining idle. Since there were no obvious signs of foul play, it seemed possible that Pat fell overboard accidentally, possibly due to a medical issue. A massive search operation was launched, which involved helicopters, search and rescue vessels, and a C-130 aircraft, but even though the search covered over 2,000 square miles, it failed to find any trace of Pat. When Pat's boat was returned to his family, they noticed some light red paint markings on the side, which they did not believe had been there before. Arrangements were made to fly Pat's son Mason home from Afghanistan to assist with the search effort, but the family soon received some bad news. At around 12:15 p.m. on February the 5th, 9 days after Pat disappeared, a boat on a charter fishing trip was traveling through the southern part of Tampa Bay and approaching the Emerson Point Preserve, which is located on the west side of Sneed Island near the mouth of the Manatee River. They wound up coming across a male body floating in the water about a half mile from the island, which appeared to have a large chunk of its face missing and was completely unrecognizable. When the FWC were summoned to the scene, they discovered that the victim had a 3/4-inch thick rope wrapped around his body, which was tied to a 25-pound anchor that had dug into the sand at the bottom of the bay 4 to 6 feet below. The body was retrieved from the water, and it turned out he was carrying Pat Mullins' wallet. When his fingerprints were compared to the prints from Pat's military records, a positive identification was made, and Pat's family were informed about his death. The location where Pat's body had been floating was several miles southeast from where his abandoned boat was found, so this only opened up a ton of unanswered questions. In order to wind up at the spot where he was found, Pat would have needed to take his boat out onto the Braden River and travel north until he reached the Manatee River. He would then need to travel west until he wound up in the southern portion of Tampa Bay. According to Pat's family, since his boat was designed for shallow water, he usually restricted himself to the Braden River and did not often travel to the Manatee River. The Manatee County Medical Examiner, Dr. Russell Vega, was unable to determine a specific time of death for Pat, but since he was only in a moderate state of decomposition when he was found, this seemed to indicate that he had been submerged in the water for several days. Aside from one missing shoe, Pat's body was fully clothed, and it turned out he was weighed down by the same anchor which was missing from his boat. The rope which was tied to the anchor had been wrapped across Pat's left shoulder twice before it went down in between his legs. It was then wrapped around his waist 7 times and tied off across his chest. However, Pat's hands were not bound, and the knots were tied in front of him, so it would not have been impossible for him to wrap the rope around himself. A reconstruction of Pat's skull revealed that he had 6 exit perforations on the left side and 1 large perforation on the right side. This seemed to indicate that someone had used a shotgun to fire buckshot, which ordinarily contains 8 to 10 marble-sized pellets, at a slightly upward angle through Pat's cheek below his right earlobe. Even though it appeared that only 1 shot was fired, a portion of the skull could not be found, so forensic anthropologists from the University of Florida said they could not rule out the possibility that Pat had been shot more than once, possibly with multiple firearms. Since there were no injuries on Pat's body to indicate a struggle had taken place, and no concrete evidence of foul play, Dr. Vega could not rule out the possibility that Pat's gunshot wound was self-inflicted and his death had been a staged suicide. As a result, Pat's official cause of death was listed as undetermined. Due to a miscommunication between the authorities, Pat's family did not learn that he had been fatally shot until 5 months after he died. They wound up learning this information from Dr. Vega, who assumed they had already been told by law enforcement, but they never were. While Pat's death was not officially classified as a suicide, the Manatee County Sheriff's Office seemed to believe that he took his own life. They theorized that Pat could have wrapped the rope around his body, tied it to the anchor, sat on the edge of the boat, placed the anchor into the water, and then shot himself through the head before the weight of the anchor pulled him overboard. Pat's body and his empty boat then drifted several miles apart before they were both eventually found. Another theory which was pushed forward by someone from the medical examiner's office is that since Pat often liked to climb onto buoys as a prank during his childhood, he could have exited his boat and climbed onto a buoy somewhere in Tampa Bay before he shot himself and fell into the water. There was talk about examining some of these buoys for potential forensic evidence, but I don't think this ever took place. Since Pat had a life insurance policy with the school district, which had a no-suicide clause, it was theorized that he may have attempted to stage his suicide to look like a homicide in order to ensure his family would be taken care of financially. The Manatee County Detective Division Commander, Major Connie Shingledecker, pointed to the fact that Pat's hands were not tied, and she had never seen ropes wrapped around a victim in this fashion for any documented homicide. Shingledecker also believed that if Pat was murdered, the responsible party would have taken his wedding ring, wristwatch, and wallet from him, though the wallet only contained $8 at the time he was found. Needless to say, Pat's family did not believe his death was a suicide, as he did not appear to have any personal or financial problems or outward signs of depression, and never left a note behind. Pat had already started making plans to celebrate his 30th wedding anniversary in June of that year, and seemed to be looking forward to his upcoming retirement in 2014. On the same day Pat went missing, he had stopped by a farm store in order to purchase a drain valve for an air conditioner, as well as a pair of welding goggles. Pat said he did not need welding goggles for anything at that point, but decided to pick them up anyway because they were on sale at a discount, and he figured he might use them at some point in the future. But if Pat was planning suicide later that day, why bother purchasing the goggles? Jill did acknowledge that in the week prior to his death, Pat had been suffering from severe headaches and was more irritable than usual. While this may have been the result of something stressful which was taking place in Pat's life, he never conveyed if anything was bothering him. Since Pat was an experienced boater, his loved ones did not feel that the knots on the rope around his body were the type of knots he ordinarily tied, which is why they suspected the involvement of an outside party. But of course, the biggest hole in the suicide theory is that the shotgun Pat had supposedly used to kill himself was nowhere to be found. Investigators theorized that the shotgun may have fallen into the water and floated a great distance away due to the strong currents. A cursory search was performed of the area, but Major Shingledecker had sent an email to her dive team in which she wrote, quote, "It is more or less to appease the family, since it would still be like looking for a needle in a haystack," end quote. Another big issue was that the Mullins family did not keep any shotguns or shells inside their house, and Pat never had much interest in owning firearms. The sheriff's office did a forensic audit on Pat's bank accounts and checked with a number of local gun dealers, but never found any evidence that he had withdrawn money in order to purchase a shotgun prior to his death. While a gun show had taken place at the Bradenton Area Convention Center in Palmetto on the same weekend Pat went missing, no one from the show recalled having seen him there, and none of Pat's friends or acquaintances reported having loaned him a shotgun either. Surprisingly, no traces of blood, tissue, or bone were found in Pat's boat, and even after luminol testing was performed, it failed to turn up any forensic evidence that someone had received a fatal shotgun blast to the head. This caused Pat's family to believe that he may have been shot at another location outside the boat before his body was weighed down and dumped into Tampa Bay. There were no black marks found on Pat's skull, which should have been caused by a close contact wound if Pat had placed the shotgun against his skin before he killed himself. While Pat technically could have held the barrel of the shotgun a few inches away from the right side of his head before he fired the fatal shot, this would have made it exceedingly difficult for his right arm to reach far enough to pull the trigger. While Pat's face had been messed up by the shotgun blast, there was a surprising lack of animal activity on his body from scavengers, even though he had supposedly been floating in the water for 9 days in a heavily traveled area known for having sharks and alligators. This once again fueled speculation that Pat's body could not have been in Tampa Bay during the entire time period he was missing, so it was possibly placed there a short time before he was found. The only reported eyewitness sighting of Pat after he left his residence was from a man who thought they saw a boat similar to Pat's traveling out of Terracea Bay towards Tampa Bay at around 6:20 p.m. on January the 27th. While he remembered seeing one person aboard the boat, he was not sure if it was Pat. If you follow Pat's route from his residence, if he traveled west on the Manatee River and arrived in Tampa Bay, he would pretty much have to do a U-turn and travel east before he wound up in Terracea Bay. I'm not sure why he would be traveling out of Terracea Bay into Tampa Bay, so it's possible this witness simply mistook Pat's boat for another one. But while we're on the subject, in order for Pat's boat to have traveled from the Braden River into Tampa Bay, he would have needed to go under the CSX train bridge on the Manatee River. Since the bridge had mounted cameras on it, surveillance footage could have shown if Pat himself or other individuals drove his boat into Tampa Bay. The Manatee County Sheriff's Office would receive criticism from the Mullins family for waiting too long to request this footage, and when a file was created and downloaded onto the lead detective's computer, it wound up being corrupted. Since the footage could not be viewed, the Sheriff's Office asked CSX to resend it. But since CSX's video system recycled itself every 2.5 weeks on an automatic loop, the original footage from January the 27th had been recorded over. Investigators did attempt to obtain footage from surveillance cameras at other locations in the area, but it failed to turn up any recordings of Pat or his boat. While the investigation into Pat's death seemed to reach a standstill, his loved ones started to notice some troubling behavior from a family friend named Damon Presswood. Damon was a chef who owned a French restaurant in Holmes Beach and was longtime friends with Pat's brother, Gray Mullins. Even though Damon would sometimes see Pat at family get-togethers, they were not known for being particularly close, yet Pat's death seemed to hit Damon incredibly hard. According to Gray, Damon would sometimes show up at his house and start sobbing uncontrollably over what happened to Pat. At one point, Damon told Jill that he would sometimes stare at the Manatee River and cry for hours on end. Everyone noticed that Damon seemed to become emotional and break down every January around the anniversary of Pat's death. On Memorial Day in 2013, Damon attended a gathering with the Mullins family, and there was a bizarre incident in which Damon inexplicably tied a rope to his dog before tying the other end around himself. According to those who witnessed the incident, the manner in which Damon tied the rope around himself seemed very similar to how the rope had been tied around Pat's body when he died. As the years went on, Damon's paranoid and erratic behavior seemed to get worse, and at one point, he implied to Gray that he was using crystal meth. This detail seemed particularly interesting because one theory which had been pushed forward is that when Pat took his boat out onto the river, he wound up stumbling across something which he should not have seen, such as a drug deal, and it led to him being murdered. Damon also happened to own a boat, which he would often park along the Manatee River near the opening into Tampa Bay. Since this boat had a red stripe on it, the Mullins family wondered if this could have provided a potential explanation for the red paint markings found on Pat's boat. But when investigators asked Damon if they could take some paint samples from his boat for a comparison, he refused to cooperate. On April the 5th, 2017, Damon passed away at the age of 48, and his death was suspected to be the result of a fatal meth overdose. Following her father's passing, Damon's daughter did consent to allowing investigators to take a sample of a paint chip from his boat for a comparison to the red markings on Pat's boat. Testing concluded that the paint chip appeared to be a match, and that Damon's boat could not be eliminated as a possible source of the red markings on Pat's boat. However, since this particular brand of paint was a commonly used variety, the match did not conclusively prove that Damon had any involvement in Pat's death. So even though Pat's death was officially classified as undetermined, and the Manatee County Sheriff's Office were inclined to believe it was a suicide, it was reported by the Sarasota-based TV station WWSB in January of 2020 that the Florida Department of Law Enforcement had reclassified it as a homicide. Finally, in November of 2022, Pat's case would receive worldwide exposure after it was featured on the Unsolved Mysteries reboot on Netflix in an episode titled Body in the Bay. But this is yet to lead the case to a conclusive resolution, and after nearly 11 years, there are still no answers about the death of Patrick Mullins. So I guess you could say the trail went cold. So whenever the Unsolved Mysteries Netflix reboot drops a new series of episodes, it's almost become a running gag for websites like ScreenRant.com to publish articles titled, Everything Unsolved Mysteries Leaves Out About the Featured Case. We've seen this happen with a number of the suspicious suicide or accidental death cases they covered, such as Ray Rivera, Jack Wheeler, and Tiffany Valiante, and more often than not, these details which were left out do seem to point towards their deaths having been suicides or accidents all along. However, I do acknowledge that I've seen no such articles for Patrick Mullins' case, and after additional research, I can't say I found any evidence the episode left out which would point me further towards suicide. I'll state right up front that I no longer put much stock into statements from victims' family members about how they were not suicidal and loved life and had too many plans for the future. Yes, by all accounts, it sounds like Pat Mullins had a good life and was a loving husband and father and mentor to his students, who was well liked by everyone who knew him. He had no known medical or financial problems and seemed to be looking forward to retirement, but sometimes people are very good at masking their depression or mental health issues, and you have no inkling that they're suicidal until they suddenly go through the act of taking their own life. So I can't completely discount the possibility that a similar thing could have occurred with Pat Mullins. All that being said, I can definitely understand the skepticism about Pat's death being a suicide, especially since he supposedly shot himself in the head with a shotgun, yet no shotgun has ever been found. Pat did not own a shotgun, and it's never been conclusively established if he could have obtained one at the time of his death. I've seen some other suicide cases from Unsolved Mysteries, in which a firearm was found at the scene, and the show conveniently never mentioned where it came from. Whenever this happened, it would usually turn out that the gun belonged to the victim or their family, so it wasn't implausible that they could have shot themselves. But in this particular case, everyone has been very transparent about the fact that Pat never owned a shotgun and no paper trail has ever been found to prove he purchased one. I guess the one detail Unsolved Mysteries did leave out was that a gun show had taken place in Palmetto on the weekend of Pat's death, but there was no evidence that he went there to obtain a firearm. It's also worth noting that Unsolved Mysteries did not mention that Pat had a life insurance policy which would not pay out in the event of a suicide. So theoretically, if Pat was feeling suicidal, but wanted to make sure his family was taken care of financially, I could definitely see him going through this elaborate ruse where he tied himself to an anchor, sat on the edge of the boat, and then shot himself in the head, so that his body would fall into the water and just sink to the bottom. Pat may have hoped that his body would never be found, so everyone would just assume he died in some sort of boating accident, and there would be no issues with his insurance policy being paid out. When you put aside all the statements about Pat not being a suicidal person, this theory is not overly implausible, as there are documented cases of people killing themselves in a very unusual manner in order to give off the false impression that they were the victim of a homicide. But all this speculation is meaningless if the logistics of a self-inflicted gunshot wound just seem impossible. In 2021, the Mullins family hired Dr. Lori Baker, a professor of anthropology and forensic science, to perform her own analysis of Pat's death. Dr. Baker decided to perform a recreation in which a male assistant of hers would wrap a rope around himself in the same manner that Pat did, tie an anchor to the rope, and then sit on the edge of a boat. After placing the anchor in the water, this man said that it was pulling very hard on his back, and it was here when he attempted to reenact the circumstances of how Pat supposedly shot himself. Obviously, they couldn't know the exact brand of firearm that Pat used, but they performed their test using a shotgun with an 18-inch barrel. Since the gun was very heavy and unwieldy, it was quite difficult to hold, especially since the shot into Pat appeared to have been fired from a slightly upward angle through his right cheek. It would have been incredibly difficult for Pat's right arm to reach the trigger, unless the shotgun was placed directly against his skin, but the lack of black marks on his skull seemed to indicate that he did not suffer a close contact wound. Dr. Baker's reenactment was shown during the Unsolved Mysteries episode, and once you see a visual of this scenario play out on camera, it does seem all the more difficult to believe that Pat would have been able to shoot himself in that position. What's interesting is that Dr. Russell Vega, the Manatee County medical examiner who originally classified Pat's death as undetermined, is also interviewed during the episode, and after all these years, he also now has a hard time believing that Pat's gunshot wound was self-inflicted. I do think that if Pat wanted to stage an elaborate suicide, it would have made much more sense for him to obtain a much smaller firearm so that shooting himself would not be as difficult. To me, my biggest issue with the suicide theory is the complete lack of blood, bone, or tissue in Pat's boat to indicate he was shot there. I just don't see how he could fire a shotgun blast through his face without leaving any forensic evidence behind, and it's not like he could climb back out of the water and clean the mess up himself. I know the authorities tried to push forward an alternate theory that Pat could have jumped out of the boat onto a buoy somewhere before he shot himself, but this sounds like an incredibly difficult thing to do when you've got a 25-pound anchor tied to your body. The reenactment of Pat firing the shotgun into himself on the edge of the boat looks complicated enough, but just imagine trying to do this while holding onto a buoy with one arm. Since one of Pat's shoes was missing, an additional theory is that he could have used his toe to pull the trigger and fire the fatal shot into himself, an absurd scenario which was also pushed forward in another suspicious so-called suicide from Florida, which I covered on episode number 305 of the podcast last year, the 1977 death of Robert Derschel. However, if this took place, then Pat likely would have needed to place the shotgun on the bottom of the boat with the barrel facing upward. The gun probably would have tipped over after the shot was fired, and I'm not sure how it could have wound up in the water and floated away. This is why Pat's loved ones have always suspected that he was taken off his boat and killed at another location before his body was dumped into the bay. Before we start looking at potential homicide theories, I do have to address the fact that WWSB had reported in January of 2020 that Pat's death was officially classified as a homicide by the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, aka the FDLE. While this wasn't mentioned by Unsolved Mysteries or any other sources, Pat does have a profile page under the Unsolved Cases section of the FDLE website. Regardless, even if the official ruling on Pat's death is still undetermined, that doesn't preclude law enforcement from investigating any leads or tips if they happen to come in. Even though this case has often been referred to as a suspicious suicide, at no point has it ever been officially classified as one, and the investigation has never been closed. But it sounds like the Manatee County Sheriff's Office may have jumped the gun in believing Pat's death was a suicide, even though the standard practice for any investigator should be to initially treat every potential death as a homicide and only look at the possibility of suicide if the evidence leads you in that direction. The Unsolved Mysteries episode featured an interview with Lee Williams, an investigative reporter for the Sarasota Herald Tribune, who has worked on this case. Williams claims that the moment the sheriff's office pulled Pat's body out of Tampa Bay, one of their officials was already telling reporters that his death was likely a suicide, even though they had not yet examined the evidence. The official would later deny making this statement, but it's been alleged that other members of the sheriff's office attempted to pressure Jill Mullins into accepting her husband's death was a suicide. Things reached the point where Pat's family said they went to the Florida Department of Law Enforcement and asked them to take over the investigation. In a lot of these type of cases, you'll see major friction between law enforcement and the victim's families, but what's unusual here is that the original lead investigator, Sheriff's Detective Daryl Davis, was a former student of Jill's when he took her English class during high school. In fact, Jill had given Davis a heart-to-heart talk that year, which helped him put his life and academics back on track. Davis was the one who personally informed the Mullins family about the discovery of Pat's body, and he even led them in a family prayer. Given their history, you'd think that Davis would be the type of guy Jill would want to investigate her husband's death, but I get the impression that he was just too inexperienced. In fact, at one point, Davis told the press, quote, "I haven't worked any murders, but this is a death investigation. I think I did a thorough investigation to the best of my ability, best of my knowledge. There's nothing I would change," end quote. Jill claimed that Detective Davis told her that she needed to be quote-unquote reasonable and implied that it was in her best interest to accept the suicide ruling, though Davis later denied saying that. But there were times when it seemed like Davis was more interested in offering spiritual guidance to the Mullins family rather than performing a full-fledged homicide investigation. Here is a passage of an actual email that he sent to Jill. Quote, "It is my most sincere prayer and desire that God will provide you comfort in the midst of what you're going through. I know it has been very hard for you and your family during this ordeal. I only wanted to provide the best answers that I could during the course of the investigation. I know we will forever be tied together in life. You were very instrumental in my growth as a young man, and I am indeed grateful that God placed you in my life. My petition/prayer is that you will be given that understanding/acceptance going forward. Great occasions for serving God come seldom, but little ones surround us daily. Thank you for believing in me." End quote. Well, in response to this, Jill stated, quote, "I was looking for confirmation that the sheriff's office was doing their job, not what God would be doing." End quote. I mean, I guess that Davis meant well and was doing what he felt was best for the Mullins family, but he was also responsible for letting what should have been the most important piece of evidence in this case slip through his fingers. As you recall, in order for Pat's boat to have traveled from his residence to Tampa Bay, he would have needed to pass under the CSX train bridge on the Manatee River, and if the security cameras on that bridge had captured footage of anyone else besides Pat in that boat, or even another vessel towing his boat, then this mystery may have been solved a long time ago. But it sounds like Davis really dragged his feet when it came to obtaining this footage from CSX, and took a lot more time than he should have. Yes, it's not his fault that he was sent a file containing the footage, which wound up being corrupted, but if Davis had not waited so long to look at it, then there still would have been time for him to obtain an uncorrupted version of the file before the footage was recorded over. I've seen some people speculate that the loss of this footage might be some sort of conspiracy or a cover-up, but I doubt it was anything more than the result of a sloppy investigation from a novice detective who had never worked a homicide before and did not approach it with the necessary urgency. So what's unusual about this whole situation is that whenever Pat took his boat out, he usually did not venture outside the Braden River near his home, and it would have been uncharacteristic for him to travel as far as the Manatee River. Around the time he vanished, he had apparently been planning to test out one of his outboard motors, which would not have required his boat to travel very far. So if he was the victim of foul play, what could have happened which led to his body being found in Tampa Bay and his empty boat floating all the way out in the Gulf of Mexico? Like I mentioned earlier, one of the most prominent theories is that Pat was innocently boating down the river, but then stumbled across something he shouldn't have seen, and this led to him being murdered. Pat was known for being a very helpful and generous person, so if he came across a solitary boat sitting on the water, which appeared like it might have some mechanical issues, Pat would certainly go over and see if they required assistance. Of course, the accidentally stumbled upon a drug deal theory has been pushed forward in a number of cases involving suspicious deaths, and more often than not, I'm usually skeptical of this scenario. We do see this sort of thing happen in fictional movies and TV shows, but in real life, I think most drug dealers would prefer not to complicate their situation by adding murder to their list of offenses, particularly in a situation like this, where Pat would have been out on the water in broad daylight in a populated area, and there was a potential for many people to hear a gunshot. However, as we're going to talk about momentarily, I think the reason this theory has picked up so much steam is because the individual who has been suspected of being involved in Pat's death supposedly had addiction issues with meth. Even if Pat did stumble upon something while he was out on the water that day, it seems very unlikely that he would have traveled all the way to Tampa Bay on his own. Since Pat's abandoned boat was found the day after he disappeared, something obviously happened to him before then, but there's been debate about whether his body could have been in Tampa Bay during the entire 9-day window he was missing. Not only did no one notice him for 9 days, but there was not a lot of animal activity on his body, which seems surprising, given that he had a shotgun blast to the face, which should have drawn scavengers who are attracted to blood, such as sharks. While the medical examiner was unable to determine Pat's exact time of death, I'm not trying to imply that someone held him in captivity for days before dumping his body into the bay. I think it's possible that Pat was killed on the same day he disappeared, and the perpetrator used the anchor to weigh him down in the water. However, after a certain amount of time, bacteria in a dead body will generate a lot of gases during decomposition, which can cause a body which has been submerged in water to float to the surface after a certain amount of days. If this was a homicide, the perpetrator may have hoped that the 25-pound anchor would be enough to keep Pat's body underwater until it was taken care of by a shark or something. But when he floated towards the Emerson Point Preserve, which had shallow water, that's when he was finally discovered. I know one of the reasons that Dr. Vega initially did not believe that Pat was the victim of a homicide was because he felt his hands would have been tied differently. But if he was already dead when the rope was wrapped around his body and tied to the anchor, then there wouldn't be any need to bind his hands together to restrain him. I do think it's most likely that Pat was killed with a single gunshot to the head, but since large chunks of his skull were missing, forensic anthropologists couldn't completely discount the possibility that he was shot in the head multiple times by different weapons. I have my doubts that's the case, but if this theory happened to be true, then, well, I think it's safe to say that you could completely rule out suicide. So while I have a hard time buying the suicide theory, one of the biggest problems with trying to piece together a homicide theory is that there isn't much evidence to work with at all. The only individual who has been pushed forward as a potential suspect is Damon Presswood. Forgive me for going on a rant here, but one thing which has driven me nuts is that it appears that many media outlets misheard Damon's surname on the Unsolved Mysteries episode, as I've seen so many sources say that it's Crestwood, spelled C-R-E-S-T. But I can assure you that the correct last name is Presswood, spelled P-R-E-S-S. Before the Unsolved Mysteries episode aired, Damon Presswood's name was never mentioned in any sources about this case, so I have to admit that I was a bit uncomfortable with the idea of all this suspicion being publicly cast against him over 5 years after he died. It would be one thing if law enforcement had named Damon as a suspect or person of interest, or if there was pretty compelling evidence that he was involved in Pat's death, but all we really have are instances of Damon displaying very odd and erratic behavior. Yes, it is very strange that Damon would get so emotional about the death of someone he apparently did not have a close relationship with, but how much of his behavior could have been the result of his addiction issues with meth? It's not quite clear to me if Damon already had these addiction issues before Pat was killed, or if perhaps the whole situation may have played a role in Damon's decision to turn to drugs. One of Damon's former friends was interviewed on the Unsolved Mysteries episode and referred to him as a quote-unquote sweetheart, and it does sound like he was a very likable guy whose behavior drastically changed following Pat's death. If you search Damon Presswood's name at newspapers.com, you'll find a number of old ads and articles in the Bradenton Herald for Damon's restaurant in Holmes Beach, which was named Chez André when he took it over in 1999, before he later renamed it Ooh La La. But the restaurant eventually went under, as I found Damon's name listed in the bankruptcy section of the Bradenton Herald in 2009. According to Damon's obituary, he did become a consultant and a chef at a food distribution company after his restaurant closed, but in November of 2014, the Herald had Damon listed in the civil suit section with First Bank over a mortgage foreclosure, and his name would finally be listed in the Herald's foreclosure section in March of 2016. And if you search public records, Damon also had a domestic violence arrest for the crime of simple battery in December of 2013. So it's obvious that Damon's life went through a major downward spiral during his final years, but did Pat's death play a role in this? One of Damon's friends has claimed that following Pat's death, he started saying weird things like, quote, "If something happened, would you still be my friend? Could I count on you being there?" It really does seem apparent that something was eating away at him, and we also have the account of the bizarre incident from the Memorial Day gathering where Damon tied himself to a dog in a manner which was very similar to how Pat was tied to the anchor. I mean, it's possible that the Mullins family was reading too much into this incident, but regardless of the context, that is still an incredibly odd thing for Damon to do at a social gathering, but how much of his behavior may have simply been the result of his meth use? Could Damon have lost all sense of reality and convinced himself he was involved in Pat's death, even if he wasn't? I hesitate to bring this theory up, since I haven't seen any real evidence to substantiate it, but a prevalent theory you'll often see pushed forward on Reddit or in online discussion forums is that Pat and Damon were carrying on a secret affair. Even if Damon had nothing to do with Pat's death, this could explain Damon's overly emotional reaction to what happened. I mean, this is nothing more than pure speculation, and I have no idea if there's any truth to it, but I looked up Damon's address from that time, and it's worth noting that he did live fairly close to the spot where Pat's body was found, and he was known to park his boat on the Manatee River near the opening into Tampa Bay. When you couple in Jill's account of how Damon would sometimes stare at the Manatee River and sob uncontrollably, it's not implausible that Pat could have bumped into Damon's boat on the water at some point on the day he disappeared. In the eyes of the Mullins family, the strongest evidence of Damon's involvement in Pat's death is the fact that red paint samples from his boat seem to match the unexplained red markings on Pat's boat. But since this was apparently a very common brand of paint, that's hardly definitive evidence. I should mention that if you search online, you'll find some reports by a private investigator that the Mullins family hired to work on this case, and they mentioned that the marker number 10 buoy in Egmont Channel had red paint, which was also similar to the red markings on Pat's boat. Since the abandoned boat was floating in the area, I suppose an alternate explanation is that it could have rubbed up against the buoy, and that's what caused the markings. However, if you search hard enough on Reddit, you'll find some comments from a poster claiming to be Jill Mullins, who says that following Pat's death, Damon's boat nearly sank no less than 3 times, and she theorized that this might have been intentional and a possible attempt to destroy evidence. She also mentioned that following Damon's death, his boat was subject to luminol testing, and even though they didn't find any forensic evidence, you have to remember that this was several years after a crime could have taken place. But let's just say that Damon is the killer. How do you conclusively prove it now that he's dead? This isn't one of those cases in which there is DNA evidence to posthumously link a deceased suspect to the crime. If you put any credence into the stumbled-upon-a-drug-deal theory, I suppose it's possible that someone else was personally responsible for shooting Pat, but Damon was present in order to witness the murder, which is why he became overwhelmed with guilt. I guess that would be the most ideal scenario for helping Pat's family receive answers, because even though Damon is no longer with us, this theory means there could still be another killer or killers out there waiting to face justice. If Damon was the sole perpetrator, then he took that secret to his grave, so finding out what really happened here would be a lot more complicated. Like I mentioned earlier, I do feel uncomfortable directly pointing the finger at Damon, since there isn't much evidence against him other than a supposed paint match and some erratic behavior. He is also no longer around to defend himself, and unlike many other deceased individuals who are looked at as potential suspects in cold cases, it's not like this guy was a career criminal or anything, as Damon appeared to be a very well-liked individual who was living a good life until he ran into addiction issues. Even though there are a number of other unsolved mysteries cases out there in which it's apparent that a victim's family is in serious denial about a suicide having taken place, I'm really not inclined to believe this is one of them. While I can see someone staging a bizarre suicide in order to make it look like a homicide, I just don't think the logistics make sense in this particular case. I do believe that the Manatee County Sheriff's Office botched the investigation by initially writing Pat's death off as a suicide, as they may have overlooked potentially important pieces of evidence which could have shed some light on what happened. I do hearken back to the fact that Damon was experiencing severe headaches during the last week of his life, which Jill believed may have been a sign of stress. I'm not sure if this stress would have been strong enough to drive him to suicide, but it does make me wonder if something was going on in Pat's personal life at that time which his family did not know about. That could be the key to solving this puzzle, because overall, this is a pretty perplexing case, and I have a hard time coming up with a conclusion which makes 100% complete sense. All that being said, if you happen to have any information about the unexplained death of Patrick Mullins, please contact the Manatee County Sheriff's Office at 941-747-3011. That's 941-747-3011. Or you can also contact Manatee County Crime Stoppers at 866-634-TIPS. That's 866-634-8477. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now, the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, So please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. Over the past 5 years, our Patreon page has released over 60 exclusive bonus episodes, which are all currently available in our archives for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3. This past month, I actually released a bonus episode about the 1981 murder of Rhonda Hinson, which is technically our podcast's very first edition of The Trail Revisited. I covered that case all the way back on episode number 4, but since I've learned a ton of new information in recent years, I decided to take a fresh look at the case and put together an entirely new episode. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spinoff podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discuss the 2006 disappearance of Maureen Fields. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries, and we now have nearly 60 of these commentary tracks in our archives. I'd also like to give a shout out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are etc. etc., Yvetta J., Jacqueline R., Alexandra S., Brandt E., and Somerset H. Thank you all so much for your support. I also wanted to remind everyone that The Trail Went Cold has once again been booked to appear on Podcast Row at CrimeCon UK later this year, which is taking place in London on September the 21st and 22nd. If you would like to purchase tickets to the event, please visit their website at crimecon.co.uk and use our specialized promo code COLD24 to get a 10% discount on tickets. Once again, that's crimecon.co.uk and the promo code is COLD24 for 10% off tickets. I just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. So have yourselves a great week, and join us again next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. Thank you.